And we're on.
And welcome back to the $25,000 Mystery Quiz with your host, Smiling Ray Sunshine.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you. And welcome back to the middle of our exciting first round with our guests, Dr. Les Work and Miss Sylvia Mouse. As you recall, Dr. Les has completed the first round and he hasn't answered a single question right. Let's see what Sylvia can do. As my lovely assistant Binky moves to the pyramid, let me remind you, Sylvia, that the three remaining categories are cartoon characters, colors of the rainbow, and the Book of Daniel. Now our super smart computer will mix up the categories and... Sylvia, what's your choice?
I'll take number two.
Number two. Number two is the Book of Daniel. I might inform our home audience at this point that during our commercial break, Sylvia showed great skill in biblical knowledge as she and Dr. Les engaged in a lively debate. Let's see what she knows about the Book of Daniel. Sylvia, again, you have 30 seconds to answer three questions. The first of the questions is, in what year was the Book of Daniel written?
Oh, I know that one, the 6th century B.C.
That's right.
Wrong, that's wrong.
Question number two is...
Wait a minute.
Stop the clock. Dr. Les, what's the problem?
Look, Ray, I'm really sorry, but you are wrong again. Some people agree that the Book of Daniel was written in the 6th century, but frankly, that's the traditional approach and it's outdated. The contemporary view is that the book was written in the 2nd century, and unless you can come up with evidence that it was not, your theory is full of worms.
Evidence. Actually, Les, that's what our second question is about. Since we have the clock stopped, ladies and gentlemen, let's break for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with the second round of the $25,000 Mystery Quiz.
The class objectives are: explain the difference between the traditional and liberal dates of the Book of Daniel. Second, present historical evidence to support traditional dating of the Book of Daniel. You might ask, why is Daniel in the critic's den? It contains detailed, accurately fulfilled prophecy. The prophetic utterances of Daniel extend literally to the end time of Hebrew history and the destiny of nations. Such amazing, accurate prophecy would defy even the remote possibility of human origin. If these prophecies were composed in the lifetime of Daniel, 595-30 B.C., they would compel our acceptance of special revelation from a transcendent personal God intervening within history. No anti-supernaturalist position could ever defend that. Is the book authentic? Was it written when it purports to be written between 590-530 B.C.? Or was it written after the fulfillment of many of the prophecies, 162-165 B.C.? The liberal tradition is that it was written after the prophecies, 162-165 B.C. And that is the only way to evade the testimony, is to allow for previous fulfillment before the book was written. In other words, it would be a fraud. Dr. E.B. Pusey, the late Regius Professor of Hebrew and Canon of Christ Church, emphasized the writer, were he not Daniel, must have lied on the most frightful scale, ascribing to God prophecies which were never uttered, miracles which are assumed never to have been wrought. In a word, the whole book would be one lie in the name of God. In fact, the authority of Christ would be fatally compromised by a late document hypothesis. Matthew 24, Jesus very clearly appeals to the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet that had not yet been fulfilled at that time. Now again, as I said about Isaiah, if Christ were in doubt about the identity of Daniel, then why wouldn't we question his opinion about his own identity? Anything appearing or claiming to be supernatural or miraculous must be discounted as fictitious. Well, men and women, you have it all the way through the book of Daniel. The appeal to the supernatural, God's intervention, and the miraculous. Because of the time situation, let's go right into some of the evidence. And what I like to do is state, basically, what the radical critic says, and then what, briefly, some of the evidence of history shows. The archaeological evidence is relating to Babylonians' history. Now you have to realize, men and women, archaeology is a new discipline. Only since actually World War II has it really gotten off the ground. It was hardly ever even established before World War I. And so many of your discoveries have been recent. But many of the criticisms they keep parroting were recorded way before even archaeology. One is that, and this is a positive aspect of evidence here, is the accuracy concerning Babylonian history that has been revealed by archaeology and inscriptions. That would be very difficult for a person. 162-430 gives a very true picture of Nebuchadnezzar's building activities. In the story of Darius ordering Daniel thrown into the lion's den, it's very significant in its historical accuracy. Because now inscriptions and things have revealed that Darius was a fire worshiper. And he in no way would throw anyone into the fire like Nebuchadnezzar did. And that is the explanation of why he threw him into the lion's den. And how in the world would somebody 162 BC be aware of that acute detail? There is no other writings or anything except going back to that century of any reference to it. The practice mentioned in chapter 6, verses 8, 12, and 15 of mentioning the Medes before the Persians. In the time described in the book of Esther, and after Daniel, the Persians were always listed before the Medes. It was the Persians and the Medes. But now, inscriptions and everything have shown that in the 6th century BC, the Medes were listed before the Persians. Now how would a 162 BC writer know that? When even in his time it was always the Persians and the Medes. Then, it's interesting, in Daniel 6, verses 8, 12, and 15, the emphasis that the law of the Medes and the Persians, once it had been established, could not even be broken by the king. Now this is almost diametrically opposite of most laws in history. Especially where you had kings that could constantly break it. And only as they go back, the inscription and everything taken back to the 6th century, could they ever understand that once the Medes and the Persians' law had been established, even the king could not break it. Which was so different than most situations in history. But these are just a few of the historical details that would be very difficult to see how a 162 BC writer could ever know it. And then concerning Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the son of Nabopolassar. In Daniel 4, verse 17, this is page 10b. Daniel 4, verse 17. It says, concerning Nebuchadnezzar, that he was setteth up over it the basis of men. These words are quite a remarkable reference to Nebuchadnezzar's humble family origin. And the origin was, from all the research done, was totally unknown until the discovery of an inscription made by his father, Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar said, or the inscription says, Nabopolassar, the just king, when I in my littleness, the son of a nobody, sought faithfully after the sacred places of Nebo and Merodach, had perceived the intentions of me, the insignificant, who among men was not visible, I, the weak, the feeble. Now it's amazing the accuracy that Daniel portrays of Nebuchadnezzar. The son of a nobody there was an expression in Assyrian inscriptions to signify non-royal birth. And the other phrase to define that was the basis of men. Then some literary evidence. The first book of Maccabees. Mattathias was the father of the Maccabean brothers of the Maccabean revolt in the intertestamental period between the close of the Old Testament around 400 BC and the initiation of the New Testament in the time of Christ. Encourages his sons in the revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes by recalling them to them the deeds of their fathers. In 1 Maccabees 2, he is quoted as saying, Ananias, Azarias, and Mishael, by believing, were saved out of the flame. Daniel, for his innocency, was saved from the mouth of the lions. Men and women. Mattathias died 166 BC. And you have him quoting the book of Daniel. Before even the prophecies had been fulfilled about Antiochus Epiphanes. And to me, this is an exceptionally strong argument. You have a man of that day, the religious leader of the Jews, encouraging his people by quoting their forefathers, and one of them, Daniel, now men and women, if it wasn't written to a year later, not earlier, a year later, his son sure must have been stupid. And it totally would have avoided anything he said in his book. He died a year before they said the book of Daniel was even written. Then the Septuagint, translation of some of the specific Aramaic words used in Daniel. Now here you have Daniel in Aramaic. It's translated in the Septuagint into Greek. And the translation of technical words mainly read to government officials like counselor, treasurer, and judges are mistranslated. Now this doesn't make sense if Daniel was dated in the Maccabean period, 160-some BC. The Jews during that time retained or had the ability to speak both Aramaic and Greek. Now, if the scholars of that day totally mistranslated some of the Aramaic words from a document of their own time, it's pretty hard to understand. To me, the only way it could be understood, the mistranslation by the Septuagint and Theodotion, is that there was about 400-500 years gap from the Aramaic used and the Greek translation. The book of Baruch, an apocryphal book, assigned by many scholars to the 4th century before Christ. In 1st and 2nd Baruch, the author bids men pray for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, that was another spelling for Nebuchadnezzar there. The king of Babylon, don't laugh, you ought to seem to get 4 or 5 different ones. The king of Babylon and for Belshazzar, the other spelling is Belshazzar, his son. Now men and women, how did he ever learn of Belshazzar? The knowledge of Belshazzar seems to have totally disappeared by the time of Herodotus, 450 BC. Any knowledge of Belshazzar as a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar and as a king of Babylon. There is no other book of which we now know containing Belshazzar's name. Inscriptions now, yes, thanks to archaeology. Other books, nowhere in history, only Daniel. These critics claim the Egyptian campaign mentioned in Daniel 11:40-45 never happened. Now, men and women, there's a reference to Belshazzar, and I'm going to continue that in just a second. There's a reference to Belshazzar, which was totally unknown in literature at the time, 162 BC, even 300 years before, with Herodotus unknown. And prophecies about events that they said did not take place. It seems inconceivable the Jews would accept the book of Daniel. God had already told the people, you can read it in the Jewish literature, you can read it in Deuteronomy 18:20-22, they were to reject and kill any man claiming to be a prophet whose predictions failed to come true. According to critics, the events foretold in Daniel 11:40-45 never occurred. And yet they said the author predicted this end to Antiochus Epiphanes. And you're right, it hasn't occurred yet. It's still to take place. The critics said it was applying to Antiochus Epiphanes. So here they say is a prophecy about a man who lived at that time and was never fulfilled, and yet the Jews totally accepted it. And it was a fictitious document of that time. Men and women, that goes contrary to everything in the backbone of a Jew in history. Sir Robert Anderson, the English scholar, states why Daniel couldn't be a fraud. The Sanhedrin of the 2nd century BC was composed of men of the type of John Hyrcanus. Men famed for their piety and learning. Men who were heirs of all the proud traditions of the Jewish faith, and they died for it, and themselves the successors of the heroes of the noble Maccabean revolt. And yet we are to believe, we're asked to believe that these men, with their extreme strict views of inspiration, their intense reverence for their sacred writings, used this authority to smuggle into the sacred canon a book, which was a forgery, a literary fraud, and a religious novel of recent date, who had not met the qualifications of a prophet. A little more than one can swallow. Some other historical evidence there in 10F. The history of the Chaldeans. Now let me give you some background here. In Daniel 2, because of time I'm not going to read it. In Daniel 2, there are several references to the Chaldeans. They're referred to as a people, a tribe of people. And then in Daniel 2, where the wise men, the astrologers, and everything else are called before the king to interpret the image of the beast, he called the Chaldeans as a caste of wise men. And the critics say, wait a minute. In the 6th century B.C., there was never any room for the Chaldeans to become a caste of astrologers or wise men. To a tribe of people. And this was a strong emphasis. And yet Daniel purports that they were also known as a caste of wise men, the Chaldeans. Diodorus Siculus, the 1st century B.C., reports, quote, the historian says, the Chaldeans, after inhabiting Babylonia for many centuries, I get this, as a kind of priestly caste, attained political supremacy through Nabopolassar. That's a secular source. Then Herodotus, the 5th century BC Greek historian, in his histories, Herodotus to his visit to the Chaldeans. The festival celebrating during Herodotus' visit was an ancient one. And Herodotus pointed out that the Chaldeans told him that in the time of Cyrus, 539 to 530 BC, the temple contained a huge gold statue of a man. Now that's going back to the 5th century B.C. in a secular setting. Now, men and women, I think very easily that gold statue would date right back to the 6th century. And the secular historian learned this from the caste of the wise men, the priests, the Chaldeans. Now, they all do from silence. Now, this, I had this, he said, the name of Chaldeans is not found in any other Assyrian-Babylonian language of the 6th century, of the time of Daniel. Never referred to as a caste of priests. That sounds pretty good until you realize the only 6th century Aramaic document that exists today is Daniel. And so, of course, if you don't have any that survived, you wouldn't have any mention of the caste of the astrologers called the Chaldeans. What about the Babylonian kings? Daniel says of Belshazzar, a Babylon, and some of the translations bring out that Nebuchadnezzar was his father. Now, men and women, in all the secular lists of kings, Belshazzar is never mentioned. And it's documented in history, according to critics, the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus, killed in 539 B.C. And yet it says Belshazzar's father was Nebuchadnezzar, and that Belshazzar was the last king. So you have a direct conflict with history. Why is Nebuchadnezzar called the father of Belshazzar four times in Daniel 5, 2, 11, 13, and 18? Also, the references his, your, my, attesting to the relationship. The Aramaic word for son can be translated four different ways. Son, grandson, descendant, offspring. Was there a genetic relationship between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar? The critic would say no. Now, gentlemen, Nabonidus married daughter of Nebuchadnezzar in order to legitimize his taking of the throne back in 556 B.C. It would follow that his son by her would be the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. You say, now, boy, that's stretching it. No, it isn't. If Nabonidus did this, he just simply followed the precedent sent by the man before him. When Nergal-Sharezer married one of the daughters of Nebuchadnezzar to legitimize his right to the throne. Have that in secular history. And you know, I think this probably did take place with Nabonidus because Nabonidus named one of his sons Nebuchadnezzar. Now, why the kingship terminology? Archaeology has shown that Nabonidus took up residence at Taman, that's in North Arabia, and left Belshazzar in charge of the northern frontier of the Babylonian Empire. Thus, Belshazzar became the de facto king of Babylon or sub-king. You say, now, wait a minute. That's a lot of conjecture. No, it isn't. It's documented in inscriptions and archaeological discoveries. Shows that much of the reign of Nabonidus, his eldest son, Belshazzar, acted as co-regent. When Nabonidus took up residence to retire in Taman, Belshazzar exercised sole rule in Babylonia and for this reason was represented by Daniel as the last king of Babylon, even though he was a sub-king. In the annalistic tablets discovered, comes from the seventh year of Nabonidus. It says, quote, now this is a secular discovery of an inscription. The king was in Taman. The king's son, in other words, Belshazzar, the nobles and the soldiers were in the country of Akkad. Now, it goes on to say, like in Daniel 5, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. Now, the Aramaic word translated lords comes from a kindred root word translated lords in the inscription by Nabonidus. By the time the feast took place in Daniel, history shows us Nabonidus already had been as a hostage for 4 months by the enemy. And the sole ruler in all of Babylon was Belshazzar. In several building inscriptions, like cornerstones, Nabonidus associates Belshazzar with himself in such a way that indicates Belshazzar took an active part in the government as a co-regent. And the only time the two names were ever mentioned in a building inscription was when one was considered a sub-king and co-reigning with the other individual. For example, one reads, "Life for long days give as a gift to me. And as for Belshazzar, by firstborn, the offspring of my body, may the reverence of thy great Godhead be placed in his heart. May he not contact sin, may he be seated with a..." Sated? That's interesting. "With a fullness of life." The Persian verse account that has been discovered, it was discovered by Sidney Smith, proves that Belshazzar ruled as king in Babylon in his father's absence during his expedition to Tama, where he was captured. The Persian verse reads this way, and I'll relate it back to the cuneiform document. "He, Nabonidus, put the eldest..." Now, who was his eldest? We go back to the building inscription. The building inscription said, "Life for long days give as a gift to me, as for Belshazzar by firstborn." Who was the firstborn? The eldest. So Belshazzar is referring to here. "He, Nabonidus, put the eldest, Belshazzar, his firstborn, in charge of a camp. The troops of the land he sent with him. He freed his hand." Now, notice, for years what the critics have been saying, that Belshazzar couldn't have reigned, was not the son of Nabonidus, anything. Now notice what the second inscription says. "He entrusted the kingship to him." To who? His eldest son, his firstborn, Belshazzar. "While he himself set out on a distant campaign." Men and women, secular inscriptions now bear out that Daniel was correct in the mention of Belshazzar as a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar and was the last king to reign in Babylon. You know, up until a few years ago, there was absolutely no inscription, no mention of Belshazzar. And you should have heard the critics then. I mean, you know, I could have stood up here a few years ago and quoted some of this stuff and never been found yet. And think what the Christians went through then when they talked about Daniel. I've learned one thing. An argument from silence is very fragile. History has shown. If you argue that it's not true because such and such hasn't taken place, you better be careful, because wait around. Archaeology is still digging. Linguistic evidence. I'm going to skip over the linguistic evidence because of the time. I've written it out pretty much for you right there. One interesting one is that there's three Greek words used. And they said at the time of Daniel's 6th century, Greek wasn't even known. And this has been one of the main sources of saying Daniel was a fraud. Written 162 B.C. after the conquest of Alexander the Great, 300 some B.C. That before then could never have had any Greek words. I went back and checked it out for new inscriptions. Page 10K, I gave you a list of archaeological discoveries and things referring to Greek people and Greek terminology going back almost 100 years before Daniel in that part of the world. Now let's go to the game show again. See what's happening.
Now, back for more of the $25,000 mystery quiz with your host, Smiling Ray Sunshine.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you. Folks, welcome back. As you know, we're in the middle of the round with our contestant, Miss Sylvia Mouse, answering questions about the Book of Daniel. There was some consternation about one of the answers to the questions, but during the commercial break, our judges have confirmed that Sylvia was correct. Sylvia, you answered that the Book of Daniel was written in the 6th century B.C. Now, your second question asks you to provide two pieces of historical evidence to support the dating of the Book of Daniel in the 6th century B.C.
Historical accuracy. The Book of Daniel had to be written in the 6th century B.C. because of its accuracy concerning Babylonian history during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. He lived in the 6th century B.C. It's no such details.
Exactly right. Now, the second reason?
Language! The language of the Book of Daniel was often thought to be found in the 2nd century B.C., but recently works have been found using the same language that date as far back as the 6th century B.C. For example, the Persian and Greek words that Daniel uses in his book were thought to be of a later date, but they really predate Daniel.
Good point.
That's exactly right! Sylvia Mouse is going to be in our second round! Right now, let's pause for a commercial break, and after this commercial break, we'll be with you for the exciting Super Challenge Show of the $25,000 quiz!
Take a break, everybody.
Sylvia, listen, how did you know that stuff? Those were amazing points.
Well, thank you, Beth.
Listen, I'm going to have to check those things out for myself. They really look interesting. One of the things you said was language.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And historical accuracy.
That's right.
Yeah, I am really glad I've come here today.
Well, Les, I don't think you should be.
Why not?
Well, because I'm winning.
Oh,